Well, it's good to be here, and always is good to come and be with the people on this occasion. Brother was asking me if this was a usual crowd. It's about the usual crowd. We have two or three families that are not here that would come if they had a chance to, and one or two that's here that didn't always come. So it's about the usual number, I think, most of the time we have. Good to see you. Good to be with you. Brother Abercrombie was supposed to be the speaker on this occasion, but he's not feeling well. His wife, either one. Most of you probably know that his wife's mother passed away just about 10 days ago. And as a consequence, she got a lot of things that she's handling now that's unpleasant and some difficulty trying to settle things. But nonetheless, he wanted to greet all of you and express his sadness not being with you. So I was asked to speak in his place. And the subject matter had to do not with the valley as such, but had to do with our mission work that we're involved with in a number of different places. When you mention mission work, quite often we think about foreign mission, we think about going overseas somewhere. And that's most of the way I think we think of it, because it's used that way so often. But actually, the mission work of the Lord's Church is not necessarily overseas. It could be in a different country in the same continent, or it could be the next town, whichever the case is. In the case we read about in the Bible in Acts chapter 7, the church is all surrounded pretty well in Jerusalem. How many there were, we don't know. We know there were 5,000 men, and then we heard that there were multitudes added to the Lord, and all those were around the area of Jerusalem until the end of Acts chapter 7. That's when Stephen was stoned to death. And then chapter 8 tells us that at this persecution, the church had enjoyed a great deal of peace and quiet until that time. They were opposed, but they had been able to endure without a great deal of problems. But in Acts chapter 8, we find they stoned Stephen. And then because of this persecution, the disciples, except the apostles, were scattered and went everywhere preaching the word. And that's where the gospel began to spread beyond the area of Jerusalem. They're finally going not just to the north, they're finally going to the south, Gaza and chapter 8. They're finally going to the north in chapter 8 as well. Then eventually into Antioch, up to the north, and then from there over to the east, which would be into what we know of as Turkey, and then eventually into Europe, the very edge of Europe, the first congregation established, not too far from where we know of today as Constantinople in Turkey. And then, of course, down into Greece, and then from there into Rome, and from there beyond into Europe. And they were really going into foreign mission work because those were foreigners. However, they all spoke about the same language, and they all were able to primarily deal with the Jews first of all, and then in Acts chapter 9, as you know, Paul was converted, and then chapter 10, the Gentiles became had access to the gospel message. So that sort of gives us a brief idea of how the early church spread. It spread rapidly to begin with. It was something that was new, but also based upon a Jewish background where people understood God and who He was, and looking for a Messiah. And when the disciples could express the fact that Messiah has come, people honest enough in heart to understand the Old Testament predicted it and Christ fulfilled it, then of course the church began to grow and to prosper. And it did prosper, continued to prosper until the time, of course, when there was division, when the papacy began to arise, and then from there the denominations came into being. I was asked not long ago to speak on where the denominations came from. And of course it came from the departure from the truth, as we all know here. And continues today to be a departure from the truth. But I think the idea was for us to talk about ourselves, those who are here today and those we represent in those various congregations, as to our mission work that we're involved with. Of course, we have been involved in mission work, as I mentioned earlier, in places such as Louisville, Kentucky, where we didn't have a congregation, and places of that kind around us which still exist, and we still try to establish churches where people go and live into a different area that we hadn't had members before. And so through them and through contacts we make in those places, we begin to start churches. This is true in Columbus, Georgia, through in Miami, Florida, was true in Louisville, Kentucky, was true in a number of different places where churches began to grow and to prosper. The Church of Miami is not there any longer. The Church in Columbus is not there any longer. The Church in Louisville is. And then, of course, other places as well. But as far as 28 years ago, I was able to visit some people and know some people in North Carolina that have been doing some work in Mexico. And that allowed me to make contacts that we began to go to Mexico and began to work down there for about 5 years until we met the brother in Arizona. Did not know a congregation existed there, right across the border. We've been passing right by it for 5 years, didn't know they were there. Well, they found out about us, we found out about them, so we began to work with Brother Yarbrough and those people that serviced Arizona. And that work in Mexico continues to our present day. However, the congregations in Mexico are scattered. We have quite a few just south of Arizona, and then we have some a little to the west of there, and then we have some right across the border from there, then some back over to the east along the Atlantic Ocean as opposed to the Pacific Ocean. And the churches there in some cases are doing very, very well, some are not. In Mexico. At the present time, we're working with about 8 or 9 congregations in Mexico, one time more than that. But we have found that some of our brethren that we were supporting were dishonest. They were working on two sides of the fence. They were not telling us proper stories. We had to finally disfellowship some of those. And some of the congregations they were reporting to us, they were working with, were digressive congregations. So it's to went on down to now to where we're working with about 8 congregations in Mexico. That started with us about 28 years ago. It continues, and we need to go now again over to the eastern side toward the Atlantic Ocean to follow through some work we have over there. That work began with those in the Widawi area that were Roman Catholics. Well, they were converted. And eventually some of them moved back down to the eastern part of Mexico to the Yucatan area. And we went down there with them, established congregations in that area. So working with about 5 congregations there in the Yucatan and Cantamaru, which is the next state over in that area. So counting those, we have about 9 congregations we put our fingers on and really tell that we're working with them. In the meantime, in that same area of the world, this goes very, very much closer to our date than what I wanted to get to. We're working now in Belize. Belize is a country that's to the south of Mexico. It's to the west of, excuse me, it's to the west of Honduras, also on the Atlantic Ocean. We have 2 congregations there that are very, very small. One speaks English and one speaks Spanish. They're very poor, extremely poor, and nonetheless they are meeting. And then there's some other churches we're trying to work with there in that area too that are not exactly as we are, but their assembly and what they're doing is scriptural. They're being supported by some we don't support, don't work with up here, the class brethren. But nonetheless, their practice is as we would have it. They don't have classes, they don't have women teachers. And so their practice is scripture. We just know they have ties here, and that's where their money is coming from to support the preachers that are working there, one congregation in particular. Then to go back to the earlier years, which I began with a moment ago, we had Brother Claude Mickey, who had begun to publish a paper, as many of you know, some of you don't, but many of you know about it. And somehow that paper got in the hands of somebody over in Africa. And those in Africa made contact with him. And in the meantime, Brother Kent Dickinson from the Atlanta area began to work with him. And they began to go over back and forth. And so that work in Africa was the seed that goes into what we're talking about today in Africa. 4 of us have been there. Some of you don't know about the other 2, but Brenda's been over there, and Donald Thompson's been there to Africa. So they both have been there, and they know what I'm talking about, as well as, of course, Ron Scott, who's been over and over and over again. By the way, let me tell you something Ron told me a while ago. He's been going very faithfully for several years. When he's out of school, doing the summer months, and been doing a good job, and I'm very impressed by what he knows And by what he tells me, what he's found out in Africa, he's well acquainted with what's going on. So if you need any in-depth information, he can give it to you because he knows, he's been there. He's very observant of what's going on, has very good understanding of what's going on too, by the way. And I'll say that kindly because that's absolutely true. But he's been going several years. His 25th wedding anniversary he was spent over in Africa. His wife's not with him. This is his 30th anniversary. His wife would not be with him if he went. And she said, if you want to have 31, you better not go with you. So he's here this year. partly because of his wife, I guess, but also partly because he's not feeling too well. And knowing that he was not going this year, we have another brother that wanted to go and has been wanting to go for years, but he couldn't go when I went because I years ago at a time when he was in school teaching. Brother Abercrombie had been going usually in July, and that's the time he would need to go, and so I didn't want to go when Brother Abercrombie was. We don't need to go at the same time. We need to go about every 6 months apart. And so I asked Tony Whitten. Some of you know Tony well. By the way, he became identified with us many years ago from the Clash Brethren. His family has been teaching for many, many years among us. He's living in the Redoubt area now, and so he decided he could go at this time. And the reason we're going right at the time we are going, which is about 1:30 Monday morning, we leave Redoubt. We catch a plane in Atlanta at about 5:30. And then we fly to Washington, from there to Addis Ababa in Ethiopia. I'll get to that in a minute. But Brother Tony can go now, so he's going with me on this occasion. He has been to Mexico, by the way. And in the meantime, Brother Tim's been to Mexico as well and done some work down there. So they'll bring those into the picture of some work that's being done in the South. Brother Tim, you've also been to Belize, haven't you?
Yes, sir.
So he's been there too, and he knows more about that than I do. He was there several years ago. Getting back to our African work, after a while, Brother Mickey, of course, passed away, and Brother Dickinson passed away. But I was able to go over with Brother Dickinson early, many, many years ago. In fact, I asked Brother Bright, who was one of the leaders there in Africa, last time I was there in December. I asked him, I said, how long have I been coming over here? And it's surprising. He talked about their poverty and about things of that kind they have. They have memories like our old folks. I used to think old people being old could remember things. Well, I'm old. I don't remember like they did. He said, you've been coming here 22 years. And he could almost tell you the red day. I was there the first time. I can't tell you that. But this will be my 23rd year to go over there. I asked Brother Dickinson on the phone, Brother Abercrombie on the phone a while ago, when was the first time he went, and he looked in his passport. He said, I went in 2003, so he'd been going 10 years old. That's to be his 10th year, and he plans to go back later on in the fall with a brother from Arizona. Well, the work over there has made progress, a great deal of progress in the years that we have been going, to the point at which there was, at the time that Brother Mickey was there, and some that they became acquainted with and they were working with, unknown to them at the time, they were involved very deeply in divorce and marriage. Now, Brother Mickey didn't know that. Brother Kent didn't know that either. But there were some of the leaders there who were involved, and it was never known until later on we found it out. But nonetheless, they had a system there which we have found necessary to oppose very, very bitterly. They had one man that controlled the entire work in Africa that we're involved with, one man. And anything had to go through him. In fact, he got the word out that anybody who came to Africa had to come through him. He had to give their permission, he had to get arrangement from the government, and we had to go through him for our permission to get there. Well, of course, that was not true at all. And the idea was that he would meet us at the airport. And the idea next was that the one who meets you at the airport has to be able to take you back to the airport. That way he could keep his thumb on us and he'd keep us under control so he'd know what we were saying, what we were doing. Now, I've said this simply, and I don't know how many of you knew that. I said this simply to let you know that we must go back and forth over and over and over and over again to the places we're working with. We have found some of the class brethren have been supporting people in the Philippines. One in particular had been supporting for about 24 years. They'd never see him. They didn't know what he was teaching. He was teaching what we taught. And they didn't know that. And so when they found out he was posted classes and we'd be teaching, they cut him off. The point is they didn't know. They'd been supporting that man all that length of time, which agrees with us on divorce and marriage and also classes of women teachers. The same thing's true with us. We have to have people like Ron to go over there back and forth over and over about every 6 months to keep tab on things. It's not the matter we don't have brethren we can trust. We can trust brethren. We have many brethren we can trust. But every once in a while, there's a snake in the grass or as a serpent behind something in the Garden of Eden that shouldn't be eaten. Whatever it is, we have people all along that arise and that are interested in themselves, in money, in position, in power. And those are while here with Brother Saviri in Africa. Brother Saviri was one who wanted to dominate and did dominate the churches, and they were afraid of him. Act to the point at which some of them were physically afraid of his brother. He was a member of parliament, he could drive a car, he spoke excellent English, he had a good education. And he dominated the church. You want to add anything to that, Brother Ron?
No, we're still fighting his influence. So.
Well, that's what happened. But in the meantime, we found out what was going on, found out the churches were listening to him, and they were under his control. So after I'd been going over there with Brother Dickinson for two times, I realized what was going on, realized to conceive what was going on. The brethren were under his thumb, and we cannot have one man dominate the church. It's unscriptural. It's not the proper way for the church to operate. We don't operate that way here. They didn't back in Bible times, but he was of that persuasion, and the brethren allowed him to do that. Well, actually, when I found out what was going on and realized that something had to be done to stop that, to get the churches to be independent. And all that one, they told him, he was telling them where to go to preach and what to preach when they got there. And when we take money over to give the brethren, it had to go through him. I remember one occasion we took some money over across a lake on the boat and saw the people that needed some money during a time of famine like we've had recently. And we had to give him the money to hand to them. We couldn't hand it direct to them. That's the kind of control you had. Well, the next time I went over there, I didn't tell him I was coming. He didn't have to know we were coming. He had to have no permission to know that we were coming. In fact, another story got out one time too about the tea fields they had. They have a long, long, like a bamboo fishing cane they take, and they have a yellow raincoat they wear in the fields. And so the question came to us that they have to have those because that long cane is to beat the bushes to get the snakes out of the way. And then the raincoat was to keep, if a snake bit them, then it would be harder for it to the skin, so the snake, what they told was protection. Well, after I'd heard that for a couple of years, I asked one of the men who was head of one of those tea plantations, I said, "What is this long stick for?" He said, "Oh, that's to measure the area they're picking the tea from so they know where they get picked." I said, "What about the snakes?" He said, "Oh, the snakes get out of the way when you get in the field." I said, "What about that yellow raincoat?" He said, "It's to keep the rain off." So you have some things like that that you know the question, but every once in a while you wonder. Anyway, when we found out that we didn't have to have special permission and they don't have to take us to the airport, he was just keeping us under his control. That had to do with Bud Dickinson too, and the others that preceded me. I went over there and he did not know I was coming. And so I was there a whole week before he found out about it. But the point that happened is that the trip before I went, I got names, I got locations, I was able to visit the location where I knew I could go back if I needed to without him. And that was the secret to it. So we got in there, didn't have to have him, brethren realized didn't have to have him. And so they were just thrilled to know they were independent. You don't have to have a boss over us over here. I remember on one occasion, we were speaking without him at a congregation at Assembly. We had about 15, 17 congregations there that day. And we were teaching on these questions, that we all are independent. We don't have to have a boss. That's where the Pope came from. We have our own leaders in our congregation. They have no authority whatsoever beyond the local congregation. We work together. We work in harmony. And I remember them standing up, and they shouted, "We're free! We're free! We're free!" And sure enough, from that point on, the brethren just had a different light on what's going on. I remember when we called this brother in question, there was about 300 brethren there in this large building, in a whole 500, I've seen that many there. And so we withdrew fellowship from him. And the congregation just flocked to the independence as opposed to being under his thumb. Well, eventually he got AIDS, I think it was. His brother did, his sister did, if I understand what they died from, and they passed away. So the severes had been eliminated. First of all, because the brethren learned the truth, and they didn't want to follow a dictator anymore. And then because, of course, this situation was certainly uncomfortable. They were involved in marriage, divorce, they're involved in fornication, and all kind of things we found out later on. So I told you this bad side of the story because I want you to see the congregations over there now working together. They're in peace, they're in harmony. We always, as human beings, we have differences. And some of us are not going to always agree on everything, but overall, we're making progress. We have 500 churches in that area we're working with. Not too long ago, we had Brother Tony Whidden speak on a tape or a disc on the internet, and a brother in Tanzania heard him. Now, Tanzania, let me give it to you this way, you have South Africa, and then you have Zimbabwe, and then Mozambique, then Malawi, and then Tanzania. So it's the fifth country from South Africa. The equator runs along there, so it's pretty warm there. South Africa, you can have snow. In Malawi, in the middle there, we don't ever have snow or ice. Never have that at all. It gets a little cool, but it doesn't get cold at all. So he heard this tape on the internet, and he contacted the brethren over here, put out the harvester. And about us and who we were. So we were able to contact them back and forth, been contacting with them for about 6 or 7 months now. And so we have a new work going there in Tanzania, in the northeastern part. You've heard of Mount Kilimanjaro, I suppose. Mount Kilimanjaro is the highest mountain in Africa, and the airport is there. That's where we're gonna fly into. We have to first of all go from Atlanta to Washington to Ethiopia, and from Ethiopia to Tanzania, and that's where we're going to be leaving for Monday morning. So we have that new work in Tanzania now. In the meantime, we've been working in the southern part of Tanzania. That's about 500 miles from where we will be this time, and we have several churches along the border between Malawi and Tanzania, and then there's another church that we have in Tanzania we've established not too long ago with brethren from Malawi. And then we have the churches in Malawi, and then along the border between Malawi and Mozambique, which is the southern the nation to the south, we have a lot of churches there, just a whole bunch of churches along the border on both sides. Mozambique doesn't have much of the facilities in that part of the world. They have one little town we can work through. They have a service station. By the way, you don't fill up with gasoline there because it's all diesel. We tried that one day. It didn't work. We were able to drive about 100 yards, and we had to have the tank taken off that night. But anyway, we didn't know that. So there's a store there, and there's this little diesel service station, and things of that kind, but not much more. And so there we have a lot of churches in Mozambique, and then we have in the southern side of Malawi a lot more churches too. In the meantime, we have churches in Malawi going to the north as far as the upper border, but we have converted several churches around Lilongwe. Lilongwe is the capital. We had one church there that was not faithful. They dwelled away. We We converted six churches there in the Longley area from our own container brethren. And in the meantime, two of those merged, so we have five congregations there in that area. Then so coming on down, we have churches, and we have a whole lot of them in the southern part of Malawi. The churches work together real well, independently. We have no one boss over them at all. Rather than being convinced that we don't have bosses, we don't have dictators, we have leaders of local congregations, and that's the way it is. And that's the way it should be, of course. Ron, I want to ask you now, do you need to add anything to what I'm saying right here about this particular phase of it? You've been involved in saying that.
Yeah. Okay. Everything good. Keep on.
Okay. All right. So we have quite a bit of work going on there in that part of Africa. It's expanding. We have found some little problems that I want to talk to you about. Occasionally we'll find a brother who wants to have two wives, and they do. You can have legally four wives in Malawi. You often wonder why a wife can't have four husbands. It don't work that way. But anyway, when a person gets two wives, I've been very, very aware of the fact it's unscriptural. And they usually go to them and talk to them and try to correct that problem. And rarely it works. Most of the time, my experience has been, if they get married and have two wives, they want to continue that. Is that your experience or not? Very rarely we find that change. There's quite a bit of adultery going on in the area. There's quite a bit of AIDS in the area. We have women who are workhorses in Africa. If you would ever go there, you women would just be delighted to know that you don't live there. Women get up in the morning, they build a fire, they bathe the children, they go to get the water from wherever it might be, half mile, a mile away maybe. They chop the wood with their axe, they cook the meal, and then after the kids go to school, then they get a hoe and they go out in the garden and work with the husband. And then they come in and fix any lunch if they're going to have any. Sometimes they don't have it. And then at night, the same routine over again. Get the water, do the cooking, bathe the kids. They're the workhorse. And so you ought to be, and I'm sure you are, very, very thankful you don't have that situation they have to contend with. The primary means of income for our brethren, there's exceptions, but the primary means is as a farmer. If you can get a job working, digging ditches, or working some other means of that, or a woman keeping house for somebody who has money in town, then you can get a job. But very rarely out in the country can you get much of a job. Very, very slight jobs available. They can make just a very, very minimum of income, about $25 a month. We've had women working in places where they keep house, do the cooking, and so on, about $25 a month. Men, the same way, digging ditches. So most of what they have is food they grow themselves. Primarily consists of corn, which is their primary food. They love it better than anything else. Occasionally, in addition to that, they'll have sweet potatoes, and they'll have beans, which grow on a bush. They have beans also go all over the ground, but mostly bushes upon the, most of these beans upon a bush that they pick. Then they have what's called cassava, which is a root of, that they eat. And they love fish, but they just don't have the freedom to get all this like they'd like to. And then in the meantime, when the plants are planted in November, they have been in the past waiting until the third rain that comes. The first rain, fine and well. The second rain, okay, but then if the third rain comes, they say, well, it may be a rainy season, so we'll go ahead and plant. Now, sometimes they plant earlier. But after they plant that, and then, of course, it doesn't come rain, then their crops fail. They'll try later on to plant again with the seed they have left, and if it fails, they're hungry. Now, that's what's happened for the last 3 years. And not only has that happened the last 3 years, but in the 23 years I've been going over there, we've had about four of these occur. About every 3 or 4 years they have this famine over there. A rain just doesn't come. And then this time, when the rain did finally come, then it came in such torrents that there was a flood. So not only did they not have the crops growing because of drought, now when they planted the crops, the flood took the crops away. So they have, it's not funny, but it's just amazing how you can think in terms of not having anything, then it gets even worse than that. Those who have access to the river or to a stream, of course, can pump the water to where it's available. And they do that. But now they have a good crop coming on. The rains have come. The maize is producing very, very well now. And if things continue as they are, we hope to see a better crop this year and perhaps not have to feed them as much as before. This year, in the last beginning, about January the 1st, we've sent $50,000 to feed the people. And when I say we, that's all the churches combined together have sent money galore over there to feed the people. We send it to various ones who are the leaders of the congregations, and they share the money with others that we don't have contact directly with. They don't have email or a bank account or anything. So we send it to brethren that share it with other people. So we have been able to do a lot of good work that way, thank the good Lord, by brethren working together to contribute money for that purpose. This year, as far as I know, we had 4 deaths. We had 3 deaths from drowning and 1 death because a church building collapsed and fell on a brother and killed him. Churches do collapse because they're made out of mud brick. Now the bricks are usually, not always, but usually dried, and they make a pretty good brick. But quite often they put the bricks up with mud rather than cement. And of course when the water gets to that mud, it just collapses. In fact, I've seen over there a big pile of mud on the ground, about this tall. And that's what used to be a church building. It was just nothing but mud left because they didn't put it up with means to keep the rain off. We hope to see them do better this year with their crops. Somebody asked a while ago about well drilling. For several years we've been trying to drill wells or dig wells for the brethren. That has not been successful. The reason why is because when you dig a well 20-24 foot, it's about as far as we can go physically, when the dry season comes, there's no water. So the well is no good except in wet weather. It is good then, but that's all the time. But then if we have a treadle pump, that's a pump that you work with your feet, you pump it like this with your foot, then you can put a hose into a stream or a lake and bring water over and have good irrigation. And that's what most of them are using where it's successful. We have one well right now that's about 60 foot deep. When I was there in December, we tried to find a pump that would pump the water out, and we could not find one at all in Blantyre. Everywhere we went, we've bought them before, everywhere we went, they didn't have a pump. And we probably are going to be able to find one this year. Probably some will come in from India where they're made, and we may be able to buy one. But what we found is this. Where we can drill a well, we have the equipment to drill with. We drill 5 feet at a time instead of 20 foot like they do in oil wells. We drill 5 foot at a time. When we get down so deep and encase it and then buy a pump for it, and the labor involved, we find it costs about $2,500 to drill each well. And we just don't have the money to drill wells everywhere. We wish we did, but we don't. If we hired it done, it costs about $6,000. We had one well we were going to drill and pay that much for it because it was in an area there's no water at all available and hope to find water. But has not been done yet. The money was used otherwise because the people to drill it never did come to drill it. So wells are not much of a success. I wish it were, but right now it seems the best thing we can do is buy treadle pumps so better to pump water where there is water available to the gardens. And when they do that, they can have beautiful, beautiful gardens. We've eaten food out of the gardens they have made. It's good food, just like you would grow here. Tomatoes, potatoes, onions, corn, okra, eggplants, just sweet potatoes, just almost anything we can grow here, they can do it there too and do it. Years ago when I first went, I said, what can I do to help those people out over there? I know they don't have everything like we have, so I believe if I take some peanuts over there, peanuts are good for you. And I think those peanuts would probably be an ideal crop. I went over there out there taking peanuts. Their peanuts make ours look like pigs. They have peanuts that big and they are good. Because they all came to South America as corn did. Everything in South America was there, they're paying just about. And for 200 years, you can imagine, but anyway, that's the way it is. The house is made out of mud brick. They put together, if possible, with cement. And if we can afford it, we try to put a metal roof on there. What you and I would call barn tin, they call iron sheets. And we have requests all along for that. Some are not able to have iron sheets, and so they ask instead for us to send money for plastic papers. Now that's not a thing in the world, but the plastic you can buy in a hardware store, but they call it plastic papers. We try to buy it pretty thick, and it goes on top of their wood on top of their buildings, and then they put usually some type of straw or something on top of that. And it lasts a couple of years, but eventually they want to have, if they can, iron sheets. Let's, any questions about Africa right now that you might want to ask? Any of the brethren? Anything that I confused you on so far?
I might just clarify, you mentioned AIDS, and there is a real high incidence of AIDS. It's 80% or 90%, I believe. But in the church, it is almost non-existent. And I really want to emphasize that because, and they understand it's because when you're following God, you don't get into the situations that get you that kind of problem. And there is still, you know, a lot of adultery, as you said, and things like that. But it's still, they recognize that following God is a benefit both in the life to come and in this life. And so that's been really good for them.
I'm glad you mentioned that because that's absolutely true. AIDS is rampant outside the church, but in church, I mentioned the severes,
yeah,
about that. We have two or three families like that that were really, they were really terrible for the church. Members of the church, but they knew it was wrong, but they didn't know what. But very few AIDS we find in the church. It reminded me of something that I'd set my mind out to say.
Well, I used to talk about the wells, like, why don't they just go out and dig their own well? And now that I've been there, I understand that that's not really possible. You can dig a well, but like you said, when the water table drops 40 or 50 feet in the summer, you can't really. And I used to think, well, why don't they raise vegetables year round? Because it doesn't freeze, it doesn't, you know, all that. And then you get up, July is winter, it's winter there right now. And you go over there and you find that it does get pretty cool in the evening. And the difference in elevations, things like Irish potatoes, you think they won't grow at all around Melungee and places. Grapes struggle with the winter. I mean, it's not, when you give a blanket statement about it, you think, well, they ought to be all right. Well, when you go, you find out that they are fighting it and they're struggling and they really are trying, but there's a lot of things going against them that we simply don't have that problem here. And that's, I just want to encourage everybody, you think about why you want to dig a well and water to be done with it. Well, it's just not that simple.
And we could go down 102 foot, they'd have water, but
yeah.
But see, they don't have electricity to operate the pump if you buy a pump. And so what do?
And also that, you was talking about we sent $50,000 or whatever, that averages out to, you know, about half a bag of corn a church. You know, so
yeah.
It's just a drop in the bucket. And there's a lot of people helping them. The government helps them, the UN helps them, a lot of people help them, but they do really appreciate it. And they feel like they love them, they feel like, you know, the Lord's helping them. They're very, very appreciative, not like people here.
In some places, the gardens we have, well, they have been show places. Some of the governments come and take a look at the gardens we have, because they have been very beautiful gardens where you have water. They can plant at least two crops a year if they have water. They can do that, and they do. They're hard workers. They're not lazy at all. They work hard. But if you don't have water, of course, you can't grow.
The tea plantation, the sugar plantation, stuff like that, do really well. But they're European, and they build reservoirs, and they have electric generators. you know, they have things that our people just, they don't have any access to even electricity.
They have sprinklers like we have here on our irrigation, so of course they're wealthy people. Well, let me add a little bit to this though. Going to Tanzania, I received an email from England, and the brethren over there, I'll mention that in just a minute, brethren over there in England are concerned about other places than where we go. There's the one sister who goes quite a bit to places like Tibet, places of that kind. She's very dedicated. Some of you know her. She's been over here, and the family has been too. And she realized we're going to Tanzania. She said there's a doctor over there who's invented something that's very, very good for children that are born premature. They usually die. And what the ones that don't die premature, they usually take about four of them, put them together, so they can have the body heat exchanged. And that way, they have the heat they need, but can you imagine the disease that might be transferred to? So the doctor in Tanzania has invented what he calls a cot. It's something you can make yourself, very inexpensive. He puts two 60-watt bulbs underneath it. And they said, look into that, find out what it is, because we need to know how to make them for other places we're going. The sisters told me that from England. So we plan to visit the doctor in the hospital in Tanzania at Mount Kilimanjaro. Kilimanjaro, I should say, not Mount Kilimanjaro. Kilimanjaro is the airport is. And she said she wants to look into it, so we made arrangements to try to find him and try to find out how that's done so we can share it with him. And that would help a great deal too in Malawi and other places where we have a lot of children die. And a lot of women die too, very young. Also in the Philippines, we had a brother who we advised not to go into the Navy, but he didn't listen anyway. He's about 18 years old. And he was sent to the Gulf War in the Navy. Didn't have any bad problems at all. But anyway, they transferred him from there to the Philippines, other side of the world. He got to the Philippines, member of the church, member as we are, and he tried to find the Church of Christ over there. So he went down the street trying to find the Church of Christ. What he didn't realize is that Mount Pinatubo, the great volcano, had exploded. Now you can usually think about him erupting. Well, this mountain actually exploded. I kept wanting to see it. You know, where is the mountain? And I kept asking him as I kept going year after year over there. And finally, I was up in the air, they said, oh, there it is. It was not there. The whole mountain was gone. There's nothing but water oozing out of the ground, and it was hot water. So the volcano actually exploded. Well, in this, in the meantime, when it exploded, it had a large territory, just all kind of damage, many, many, many people killed. And the Church of Christ there, which had classes, women teachers, supported by our digressor brethren, it had been damaged. And so when eventually he went down the street to find the Iglesia de Cristo, they don't speak Spanish, but Spanish had controlled that for 400 years. And so now, since we've been in control since the 1900s, until we gave them the land back to them, they have Spanish names, but not they don't speak Spanish. They don't like Spanish. Don't want anything to do with Spanish because under their thumb for 400 years. Anyway, he went down the street to find an Iglesia de Cristo, and he found one. But he went inside and had an instrument, some music, and so on, and he realized that was wrong. So he asked a man about it, about the Church of Christ, and he said, oh, I know where you want to go. So far down the street to where we had, sure enough, the Church of Christ. But it was a digressive church. But he didn't know it because it had damaged the building, and they were not having classes then, and didn't have the women teachers then. It was just like we are. He wired back home, said, I found a church just like we are. Come over here. So I got on the plane and went over there. And sure enough, I found out 15 minutes after I got on the car with them that they were not like us, but he didn't know that yet. And so we spent a whole week with them. And finally, at the end of this, I think it was Friday night, end of the week, after working with them and visiting with them and talking with them, I got the leaders together and explained where we were from, what we believed, and how we felt like the Bible ordered the church to function, as opposed to the digression we've seen in so many churches. They sat silent. They didn't say anything at all. I explained about 1 Corinthians 14, 1 Timothy 2, 11, 12, other things having to do with Christ and Sunday school, such like. And so when I stopped talking, one of the brethren said, well, said, Harriet, we know those verses are in the Bible. And we've known them all the time that they're in the Bible. But the preacher from America had come over here and said, it just doesn't mean what it says. And explained it away. Explained how that it didn't mean what it said. And they said, we believe it does mean what it said. You're the first person ever come over and tell us it meant exactly what it says. And so we converted the largest church in the Philippines. And they were converted overnight. And all it took was just to tell them the truth, explain it to them. Well, from that one contact, we now have 47 churches that we're working with on 6 of the islands. Now there are 7,700 islands. Now, we're not going to get a church in every one of them because only 800 I've lived in. But we do have churches, 47 of them, on 6 of the major islands. And it's growing well, doing well. We have spent a lot of money on one island because people are very much the original people in the Philippines. They're not the modern Filipinos. They are Aborigines. These are the people that are hunters and gatherers. They live up the mountains, very, very poor, and live in very scanty surroundings, but they're members of the church, and they're very faithful. Now, I digress, your brethren, who come in there and try to buy them off and offer them money if they would let their preachers come in and work with them. And they said, nothing to do it. We know the truth and we're not going to sell out. So our brethren have stood firm as an overall picture. There's two or three preachers who've gone with them because they give them money and they're paying them to preach. But our brethren have stood firm and sure, and many of them not getting a dime from us. I think we need to say here that the work that is being done in Philippines, in Mexico, and England, we have church in England we worked with, and Africa, always we are seeing the church grow and prosper that we don't see here in our nation anymore. If you go back into the 1850s up to the 1940s, you'll see the Church of Christ growing and prospering and doing well. Up in Kentucky, you find people back in the valleys there, the valleys that they were living in, farming in. They were faithful, dedicated. But little by little, the people moved to town, the influence came back to the valleys, and the churches went astray. Now, we're not making much progress here. In fact, we're going backwards here. As far as numbers are concerned, our old people dying off, our young people are not coming in the church like they used to. And some that are in the church are drifting away. We have a few exceptions. I have some here right now tonight. Some more I can tell you about. They're dedicated young people, faithful and dedicated and serving the Lord, and we're so proud of them. But by and large, we're not growing. And that's not only true of us, it's true of the Baptists, it's true of the Methodists, it's true of others, where they don't have entertainment to allow the children to be attracted. It's the society we're living in, and the last days we're living in. But in the Philippines and in Africa, we're seeing great growth over there. So the point is, I think this, we're seeing the Lord's church is still growing, is still prospering, where there's an honest of heart, and they're not influenced too much by the secular world around us. And that's one reason we need to keep going where we're going, and keep doing the work we're doing over there. It is having an effect, it is growing, it is prospering there, even though it's not here. So appreciate so much those brethren such as you who are supporting the work, making it possible for us to go, and supporting those brethren when they have needs such as the draft. Are there any questions, any comments anyone wants to say? Well, thank you so much for listening. If you do have questions about these matters, let us know. We'd be happy, very happy to talk to you further about it. If you have an email that I don't have and you want to let me know about it, I'd be glad to take that down. And we do try to send out email messages about the work we're doing, and we'll continue to try to do that. So let me know what your email is. Thank you very much. Lord bless you.